All right, you're listening to WHUS 91.7 FM. I am Fran Storch, and this is Radio Naturopath. And I'm here with my co-host, Ron.
Good morning, Fran.
Yeah, so we got a lot of good stuff for you to talk about. And if you'd like to participate in the show, the number to call is 860-486-9487. That's 860-486-9487. You can text us at that same number, and we would love for you to participate and ask us whatever questions you like. Do get a hold of us. You can also write us at radionaturopath@gmail.com. So, lots of cool stuff. One of the things that I had begun to talk about last week was food intolerances. And so I wanted to get into that, the different kinds of food intolerances. One of the things that I find is that I'll have patients come in and they'll be interested in getting a food intolerance test. And there's a big caveat there, because I think a lot of times patients are hoping that there's some exotic food that they're eating a little bit of that's causing all their problems. And if they just avoid that cute little exotic food, that a lot of their problems are going to go away. So as long as they avoid, say, kiwi fruit and hazelnuts, everything's going to be good. So unfortunately, with food intolerances, the foods that are really giving you problems tend not to be kiwi fruit and hazelnuts.
No.
Tends to be stuff like, it tends to be stuff that you really don't want to hear about. And it's usually, if you're intolerant to a food, it's something you're eating too much of all the time. And that's kind of how it goes.
Yeah.
And So
you once told me that sometimes the things you love the most are the things that could be the thing that causes a problem with intolerance.
Yes.
Is there any connection there?
So let's use an interesting word, the word craving. Okay? So sometimes when you crave stuff, so craving is an interesting term, and we need to distinguish between the term craving versus hunger. Craving is about desire and pleasure, and craving is something that happens in your head, whereas hunger is the actual physical sensation that you need to eat. And they're different from one another. And craving, people come in and they talk to me about how they just can't help their cravings. So we talk to people about cravings. One of the things that I feel like people are looking for, they're looking for a way to eat what they crave and also lose weight. So there's ways to do that. But, you know, if it depends on what your goal is. If you have an amazing metabolism where you can break down food very, very easily and you can stay slender and you can build muscle mass with very little effort and you don't have to worry about what you eat, you can eat what you crave and possibly as much as you want of it. I will tell you that most of my patients, if they're my patients, they're probably not like that, because that's why they're my patients. And that most people in the United States, because we have a 70% rate of overweight and a 30%+ rate of obesity in the United States, I think that 70% rate of overweight is on the light side. And the obesity rate is also kind of on the light side too, because I see many, many patients who are obese. So obese just means that your body mass index is over 29, and it's not that hard to get there. I mean, for me, I'm a 5'3" person, and for me to be overweight, I need to be 141 pounds. It's not that hard for me to be 141 pounds. In fact, I'm finding that at this moment, it is not at all difficult for me to be 141 pounds. Yeah, I can kind of get away with it because, you know, the BMI isn't perfect. The BMI, body mass index, only is a relationship of weight to height, and it doesn't take into account what your muscle mass is. It doesn't take into account how healthy you are. So if you have a BMI of, if you have an elevated BMI, but your blood sugar is perfect and your health is perfect and you have good energy and you have excellent thyroid and you exercise regularly and your lipids are fine and you don't have any particular inflammation and your health is good, if your BMI is a little high, so what? Again, your BMI can be elevated and you can have a low percentage of body fat. So it doesn't take into account your percentage of body fat. And so BMI can be a deceptive term. However, most people that I see in my practice are eating too much starch and not getting enough exercise. That's just what I see. You know, it's too much starch and sugar, too much pizza, and not getting enough exercise. That's just in my everyday practice. Most people that I see are not in the category of they have an elevated BMI because they're bodybuilders. It's just not who comes. Most people are not that.
No.
No, most people are overweight because they are overfat. That's
because
what's
they're not
going
on. Doing anything about it, because they're not moving and they're not you're eating properly, and you know.
Well, you're getting judgy, Ron.
Oh, sorry.
So this is an issue that most people in this country have. So if we sit here and we be judgmental, people are not going to be happy, because
okay.
We need to help. We need to talk about how we are among. Now, you are in a special class because you're one of those people who has a really high metabolism, and you don't have to think too much about what you eat, except as long as you avoid gluten, because
mm-hmm.
You're severely gluten intolerant. Most of us have to watch what we eat, or we become overweight. I mean, I have to watch the quantity of what I eat. I have to watch the actual content of what I eat, or I will gain weight. And that I'm like most people in this country. And that's who we're speaking with. So I feel a bond with those people, because I think about every bit of food that goes into my mouth. And you don't, you know? It's different.
You're right.
Yeah.
You're right. I don't.
Except for the
gluten thing.
Yes, yeah, but if it's not gluten.
It is a big deal.
Yeah, but you can eat things that are extremely high calorie and not worry too much about it.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of those food intolerances, when we talk about a food intolerance, so people talk about food intolerances and we talk about food allergies. So we want to distinguish between the two. A food allergy is a subset of a food intolerance. A food intolerance is a food that if you eat it, you don't feel good for some reason. Something goes, if you eat it, something goes wrong in your body, whether or not you feel good. So you can have a person with celiac disease who's asymptomatic. They don't perceive any symptoms at all. But you test their antibodies, and perhaps you look at the inside of their small intestine, and you find that they, in fact, have celiac disease. So they have an asymptomatic food allergy. That is a food allergy, but it may not technically be an intolerance because they don't feel like they're intolerant. They're intolerant to it. Mm. However, they are technically not tolerating it. So their body is not tolerating it, but they are asymptomatic. So a food intolerance in the grand scheme of things, you eat a food and something goes wrong in your body, whether you perceive it or not. Mm-hmm. And you may perceive it, but and your perception of it is symptoms. And your lack of perception of it is if we tested for it, you don't perceive that you have symptoms because of it. But if we tested for it in some way, for example, someone who's asymptomatic and celiac, we find antibodies to gluten. And we're like, okay, you have, so that's an asymptomatic food intolerance. And it is also a food allergy. So what is a food allergy versus an intolerance? Very simply, a food allergy is where you eat a food and you make antibodies to it. That is, you get proteins, you get lymphocytes, white blood cells that become encoded specifically to fight against a food.
So a food allergy would trigger your immune system.
Yes. Yes,
okay.
It would. And a food intolerance might trigger your immune system. Food allergy, by definition, is triggering the immune system, because the definition of an allergy is you're having an immune response to the food. So there are different antibodies that can be stimulated to go after foods, all the same ones that can go after that can go after anything in your body, that can go after microorganisms, bacteria, parasites, all of those things. So there's a couple different cells that can be encoded to become antibodies. So you can have, if it's immune globulin E, it's going to be your eosinophils or mast cells that are going to be encoded to go against those foods. If it's going to be immune globulin A, it's going to be specific proteins that hang out on the lining of your digestive system, as well as your as well as your respiratory system, and they can become encoded to fight against foods. And then if it's immune globulin G, those can be present in your blood, and they can be present, again, on the linings of the digestive system and in your skin and pretty much anywhere in your body. IgG is what we think of as antibodies. So when you are immune to an illness, say you catch the chicken pox and you develop an immunity to it, you develop IgG, immune globulin G antibodies that are lymphocytes. They're white blood cells, this particular kind of white blood cells that get specifically encoded to have a lock and key fit to fight the chickenpox virus. So the next time the chickenpox virus comes around, those antibodies are going to be encoded to kill it, to take on that virus with a lock and key fit and then beat it up once it's attached to that antibody. Well, guess what? You can get immune globulins that are that will attach to particular food antigens. The word antigen is a word that means a protein. It's a particular protein that hangs out in the structure of the food. And again, this food, this antigen, can hook up with that antibody with a lock and key fit. And it's an immune response. So what happens basically is that chemically, that lymphocyte, that white blood cell, beats up on the food. And when that's happening, you're getting all those pieces of inflammation that we've talked about previously, tumor, rubor, calor, dolor. Remember the heat, redness, swelling, and pain? You can get all of those things happening. So figuring out what your food allergies are doesn't mean that if you have a food allergy, does that mean you have to never, ever eat it again? Well, let's talk about the different kinds of intolerances, first of all. So you can have an intolerance that's a food allergy, and you can have an intolerance that's not an allergy. So an example of an intolerance that's not an allergy is lactose intolerance. So dairy, milk. Is made up, when milk comes straight out of the cow or the goat or the sheep or whatever animal that you're drinking your milk from, even human milk, when a woman is nursing her baby, there's three basic components to the milk, three nutritive components. There's also water, which is a nutritive component. But three basic nutritive components are going to be fat, sugar, and protein. And so the dairy fat, that's going to be your cream, or if you were to clarify butter, that would be ghee. That's butter oil. So that's the fat. Protein is going to be casein, mostly casein and whey. And then the sugar is going to be lactose. So on the brush border of your small intestine, you have an enzyme called lactase. And lactase is an enzyme that breaks up milk sugar. And you have a fair bit of it when you're a nursing baby, and you're supposed to, because there's lactose in mother's milk. And so if you have a properly functioning small intestine, you're going to have lactase enzyme on the brush border of the intestine, and you'll make lactase enzyme, and you drink your mother's milk. The lactase enzyme is going to break down the milk sugar, and all is well. Then it breaks it into glucose and galactose, and you can use those for energy. You can use those to feed healthy microorganisms in the digestive system, and you know, just use them for the health of your body, and all is well. And if you don't break down those enzymes, then if you don't have that enzyme and you don't break it down into those components, then the lactose goes unbroken into the small intestine, and the microorganisms that are there will go ahead and start to break it up. And when they do that, they don't do it as efficiently as the lactase enzyme. And you get partial breakdown, and you get the production of a lot of carbon dioxide. And the more carbon dioxide you get, the more gas you get. And so if you have a little baby that winds up being lactose intolerant, they're going to get gas, and they're going to become colicky because it's painful. The gas, as it's moving through, it puts pressure on the large intestine and even the small intestine, and it's painful. So one of the things that can happen with a nursing baby, now if you have a baby that has food intolerances already and they're exclusively being nursed, it is possible that there's something quite wrong with that baby and that baby needs to be checked out. But it's not unusual for babies to be colicky. But if the baby is being exclusively nursed and they're colicky and they're not particularly unhealthy, then it is probably that there are components to the foods that mom is eating that are affecting the baby. So mom has to change her diet so that the baby, so that she's not eating intolerances that the baby has. So that can happen. Sometimes I will see babies that have terrible eczema and they're being exclusively nursed. So then you have to turn to mom and say, okay, mom, you can't eat baby's food intolerances. This is how this is happening. And I have seen cases of eczema clear up when mothers just get off basic food intolerances. And usually it's wheat and dairy. Those are the biggies. I hate to tell you. It's not hazelnuts and kiwi fruit. It's wheat and dairy. It's stuff that you eat all the time and you eat a lot of. That's what it usually is. So the other thing that you'll see is sometimes babies are not nursed and they're given cow's milk. And the problem with cow's milk is that cow's milk was developed to grow a calf to be from 44 pounds to 1 to 2 tons. So it has the perfect proportion of foods for a cow, which is a good 10 times as big as we are. That's why many people have problems consuming dairy. And this whole dairy thing, the fact that we consume dairy, is really questionable. The fact that we consume dairy and also wheat, modern wheat, is one of the reasons that Americans tend to be bigger than people other places in the country, that they're overweight, but also that they're taller and their bones are bigger.
Yeah. You love that dairy, don't you? That cow milk thing.
Well, you know, it's an issue.
I'm just kidding with you a little bit about it because you do remark on it often, and I think that you're making a very strong point.
Yeah.
I mean, it just makes sense.
So what I tell people about dairy is I tell people if you are not intolerant to it and you are thriving, you are healthy and well, and you do eat some dairy, then fine. If you're a vegetarian, you're relying on dairy and lots of dairy and eggs for your protein, nature did not intend that. If you think you're doing a good thing for yourself by being a vegetarian, but dairy is your protein of choice, I'm not saying you shouldn't do it, but I'm saying that that was not ever what nature intended. Nature intended for you to nurse on mom until you were weaned and never look at dairy again. That is what nature intended. People, I am not saying never eat dairy again. I am saying what we do is unnatural. I'm not saying you shouldn't do it. I'm just saying that at a very, very basic level, the consumption of dairy, of us consuming the dairy of another species after the age of weaning, is not natural.
Right.
It's on the one hand. On the other hand, if you want to say, well, evolution states that we did create animal husbandry. We do keep animals. We keep cattle and we keep goats and we keep sheep and we consume their dairy, and it is a tradition that we consume their dairy. Mm-hmm. And there's evidence that there's certain kinds of dairy that are pretty healthy for you, that if you do eat raw milk dairy, if you're not intolerant to it, raw milk dairy from a cow, you can get immune globulins from it. And also if you eat fermented dairy, if you eat yogurt, and if you eat kefir, those things have wonderful probiotics in it that are very good for you. But if you are relying on dairy as most of your protein, it may not be the best thing for you. And it is not uncommon. I mean, dairy is a common food intolerance. And the thing about dairy that's interesting is that dairy has that whey and that casein in it. And whey and casein are designed to increase your insulin. And they're supposed to do that. When I get menopausal women in who are like, oh, I'm perimenopausal and all of a sudden I put on 10 pounds and I can't seem to lose it and the things that I used to do to lose weight aren't working, that's very classic for menopausal women. One of the things we might say is, well, you might want to consider either cutting back or losing the dairy, especially cheese, because cheese is the last thing you want to give up, right? Because cheese has a lot of protein in it. And then people also, they love their Greek yogurt, and Greek yogurt is delicious. Why? Because it's so high in protein. And it's very satisfying without being too high in calories. I had a very satisfying Greek yogurt pop last night and took me a long time to eat. It was delicious and it had maybe 100 calories in it, you know, and it was like, it was very it was a lot of food and it wasn't very many calories. So that's one reason people like to have dairy. But the issue is every time you eat dairy protein, you have to realize you are raising your insulin. And then that protein can be used to build muscle mass. So if you're encouraging muscle mass, like you went up Maury Marcy Station twice today.
How was that?
Oh, it was good. I'll tell you in a little bit.
You can tell me later.
Yeah. So if you have some dairy protein right after that, it might go up and become muscle. But I'm going to have bigger bones than my non-dairy eating counterpart because I insist upon consuming some dairy. I don't eat gluten. I don't do amylopectin A, which raises your blood sugar and raises your insulin. But I do still consume dairy. I have a little dairy most days, I would say, because we put some cheese on our salad. I have yogurt some days. I'll have coffee drinks with, or tea drinks even, with milk in them sometimes. But I wouldn't say I rely on dairy as my main source of protein. That when I'm snacking, I try to get away from the dairy a little. I try to limit my dairy. So like if I know I'm going to have cheese in my salad, I might forego dairy other times in the day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and just keep an eye on it. So that's one way to approach dairy. If you have a weight issue and you are exercising a lot and you're, those last 10 pounds, one thing you can do is get off of dairy just because dairy raises your insulin. Anything that raises your insulin is going to promote growth. Insulin is a growth promoter. Insulin is not a bad thing. In the right circumstances, it can be very helpful for you. You need insulin to drive sugar into your cells so you can do stuff. People who have diabetes who can't make insulin, their life is threatened. They have to take insulin every day to drive that sugar into your cells. In order to get sugar into your cells, you have to have insulin. You also, insulin is a traffic director. It says, you go here, you go there. It's not a bad thing. Insulin will do, it responds to what you do with your life. So it's not just like, oh, I'm insulin resistant, I have to get rid of my insulin. No, it's not like that at all. Insulin is good for you. If you have become insulin resistant, then you have to find ways to make yourself more sensitive to that insulin so you don't need as much. Insulin would be very happy to exist in a judicious and measured state in your body. But you have to ask it to do that. And the way that you do that is you have to get regular exercise, because regular exercise increases your insulin sensitivity, because if you get regular exercise, your cells are going to be calling out for that sugar. Come on, she's asking me to move her body. Insulin, you got to bond to this cell so you can push some sugar in so she can do what she needs to do, especially those muscle cells. And those muscle cells get taxed. Muscle cells, when they're taxed, they like to repair. And then if you eat good quality protein, you're going to repair those muscles, and then you'll have muscle mass. When you have muscle mass, you have the more muscle mass you have, the more metabolism that you have, and the more you can get away with eating. So it's a nice thing. And these are reasons to exercise. So you heard it here. If you exercise, you can eat more. Why? Because you have more metabolically active tissue. So if you don't exercise, the less you exercise, the less you can eat. That kind of makes sense, right?
Right.
Okay, so getting back to food intolerance. So you can be intolerant to dairy by being lactose intolerant. And that's a food intolerance. It's not an allergy. So the allergies usually happen with dairy when you make antibodies to it. So like I said, there's three kinds of antibodies. There's the antibodies that are made from eosinophils and mast cells, immune globulin E. Those antibodies will tend to cause acute reactions. And if you have a serious reaction, it can be life-threatening. So, when you talk about people having peanut allergies and needing to carry around an EpiPen, well, that means that person has an IgE allergy to peanuts. That means when their body sees peanuts, it makes an extreme reaction to it. And it makes the kind of reaction that causes hives. So hives can pop up on your skin, but they also can pop up in your digestive system and in your respiratory system. And that's why having that kind of analogy is so dangerous. You're basically getting hives in your respiratory system, and that's how you get what's called anaphylaxis. That's when you get inflammation in the respiratory tract that's so bad that you can't breathe. When you use an EpiPen is a pen that has epinephrine in it, and an acute dose of epinephrine, when you have an acute dose of sympathetic hormones, it will calm down that parasympathetic system so that the airways can open up. And that's how that works, that you have excessive parasympathetic tone, that your rest and digest has gone into overdrive to cause that swelling and inflammation, and the epinephrine helps to calm that down. And so so when you're in sympathetic tone tends to increase your circulation, open up airways, make it so that you can breathe better, and it counteracts the effect of those food allergies. So you can go get tested for IgE food allergies. And when you go to the allergist, or the ear, nose, and throat doctor, you can get tested for food allergies. And they generally test for the kind of allergies that give you hives and or anaphylaxis. And a method that they like to use is the skin prick test. And what they do is they will take samples of foods and put it along your skin, and they know where on your skin they've put it. They've put each food, and then they have you sit there after they've pricked your skin with the different foods, and they watch for a wheal to develop, or a hive. And they watch for how big of a hive it is. And if it's over a certain amount, they consider that you're allergic to those foods. And then they'll tell you, they'll give you a list of foods that you have to avoid. And so that's an interesting thing.
So I have a question for you here.
Yeah.
So are food allergies increasing? Because it seems like all of a sudden you hear a lot more about this, especially with kids in schools.
Yeah.
And how, you know, they can't be anywhere near anybody who has peanut butter, and, you know, there's all this stuff going on. I don't remember this when I was growing up. I don't remember seeing it nearly as much as we see it now.
I think there's a couple of things going on. One of the things that's going on is that there's more, we know more now than when you were in school.
Sure.
Because you were in school 70 years ago.
Hey, let's not get, okay. Don't go down that road.
All right. It was only 65 years ago.
Oh, listen to you.
You were in school a really, really long time ago, back in the dark ages.
Back in the dark ages, right. We actually made stone tools back then.
Well, the
too.
Thing is, nobody, when you were in school, nobody had food allergies because everybody ate a paleo diet, because it was, in fact, the Paleolithic times.
Well, I have a little piece here. According to the a study, I'm just gonna avoid that. I'm just gonna try to ignore that you said that. Okay?
That was funny, right?
Very funny. Yes, you're cute.
It's not. It's really what's really horrible about what I just said is that it's really ageist, because it's. I'm joking with you that you're really old, as though being old is a bad thing.
Yeah,
and
shame
you're being,
on you.
You're being
it's like when Bill Maher said something about, "So Bernie, you're not going to run again, are you?"
Right.
Well, that's kind of an ageist thing to say, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Right.
It totally
right.
is an ageist
right.
thing to say.
Has nothing to do with how old he is. It has to do with how good he is at the moment.
Yeah. That's right. And did Bill Maher then say that?
Yes, he did.
Well, that was so. The counter to that was actually a wonderful and brilliant thing to say.
Okay.
That it doesn't matter how old he doesn't matter how old you are. It matters how good you are at the moment, or how it's. And that's what I say. Age is not the factor per se. Yes, the longer you've been on the planet, there are some things that you have to attend to. But people have different needs. You know, you can have 52-year-old ladies, and they're all going to present differently with different health issues and different statuses, and some of them can be like me.
And then there's the older and wiser thing.
Oh,
because
for sure.
Because we do gain wisdom with our age. We hope that we gain wisdom with our age, at least.
Yeah, some people, I'm not so sure.
Here's something for you. According to a study released in 2013 by the Centers for Disease Control, good old CDC and prevention, food allergies among children increased approximately 50% between 1997 and 2011.
1997 and 2011.
1997 and 2011.
They increased.
Yes.
So what I'm
50%, that's a lot.
So what I'm not sure of there is that because there's more surveillance and there's more diagnosis And it used to be that people just used to get diagnosed with spastic colon or irritable bowel syndrome. I used to hear that term thrown about, spastic colon. I never hear that anymore. Everybody just says IBS. Or even they have an awareness that they have food intolerances. I wonder that there's more awareness of food intolerances, but I can make a case that there are, in fact, more food intolerances and insensitivities today. I can make a case for that. I think that since, and it's only since 1997 that it's increased.
Right.
So this is not even since we were little kids. Because I remember growing up, I ate very differently than I eat now. Now, whenever I have an opportunity to eat something really healthy, I do. You know, so, you know, my lunch is going to have some protein in it. It's going to have some veggies in it. It's going to have some artichokes in it. It's going to have, you know, mostly protein and produce. When I was a kid, it was really normal for breakfast for everybody to have a bowl of cereal, glass of orange juice. And if you were my parents, you had coffee. And if you were me, you didn't. And maybe you had a piece of fruit, but probably not. But you had cereal with milk and a glass of orange juice, and that was breakfast. And boxed cereal was what you had for breakfast. And you had a sandwich for lunch. The sandwich was probably on white bread. It mm-hmm. might be on wheat bread, but it was probably on white bread. And the sandwich,
Wonder Bread builds
strong bones eight
strong
ways.
Strong bones, yeah, I know. Whatever. Yeah.
And if you, right, and so it could be peanut butter and jelly. Could be, my mother used to make cream cheese and jelly. Or it might be
cream cheese and bananas.
Oh, we didn't get that.
Oh, yeah, we had that.
No, we didn't.
Cream cheese and olives.
No.
Yeah.
No, bananas didn't. Bananas didn't go on sandwiches. You just got a banana. And you might have a piece of fruit in your lunch. Maybe an apple or a banana. And my mother wasn't big on buying a lot. Sometimes she would buy grapes, but she didn't buy a lot of grapes. Or she didn't buy a lot of berries. All the things that I buy now, berries and cherries and all the things that we know help you with your weight. All the things I tell people to get, she wasn't big on those. And she's still not entirely.
Well, you know, she comes from the 50s.
That generation. That,
yeah.
Although my mother is quite healthy right now.
Well, I mean,
she's,
yes.
She's relatively healthy right now because she does watch what she eats. And, you know, does eat a reasonable amount of veggies. I wouldn't say my parents are poor eaters
no.
at this time.
No, but if you take a look at that whole generation, I mean, yeah. if you take a look at, you know, the show Mad Men.
Yeah.
And it really shows, you know, how bad people were about, you know, smoking and drinking and just food in general was
yeah.
bad. It was just bad, you know, but yeah. that was the culture.
Right. And so now I tend to do more, you know, more protein and produce. And, you know, if I snack, I'm going to look for a snack that's going to do something for me. That before I eat a food, I'm like, all right, what are you going to do for me? Either you're going to make me really healthy or you're going to give me pleasure. And in a lot of cases, you're going to do both. But, it, you know, I am not going. I do eat some play foods. You know, last night I had my little bites of fudge.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I go over to Sweet Emotions and I buy the fudge and I nibble on it. It takes me a week to nibble on a couple of squares of fudge. And, you know, because I won't finish. I don't need a whole square of it. Yeah, I know. I'm not sharing it, am I?
No, you're not. I'm out of the loop on this one. I miss that completely.
I know. I keep not handing it. I'll do better.
Are you hiding things? Are you hiding
no,
food on me?
No, you know what I'm going to do? Next time I go to Sweet Emotions, I'm going to buy two bags. I'm going to buy you your very own bag and my own bag. And then
you can
do whatever you want with your
that
bag.
That would be very nice.
Okay. So that's what I'll do. And I'll give you your coconut, your chocolate haystack that you like. And I'll get you peanut butter chocolate fudge, which I know you would like.
Mm-hmm.
And some chocolate fudge with M&Ms on it. Okay. Yeah. Anyway, so the thing is, since 1997, why the allergens? So one of the things, there's a few things that are going on. You have a generation of people who grew up eating those 50s kinds of foods and perhaps not learning how to cook. And I can't tell you how many people come into my office who are like, I don't like to cook. So when they say they don't cook, I'm like, so what? How are you eating? And so mostly people are heating things up or they're getting takeout, and that's what they're ordinarily doing. They're eating foods that you don't have to prepare, foods that you can heat up, like meals that are all in one meals. So
ew.
So they're frozen meals or they're things that are not fresh, and they're not putting together things like a salad, or they're not putting together a stir fry, and they're not like eating fresh food. And that is how a lot, that's what a lot of people do. And that's just the nature of it. That is what has gone on. So if you have a generation of people that ate that way and then didn't really learn to cook, they're going to have a health profile that's a result of that. They're going to then go ahead and have children, and they're going to be in gestation having a health profile that looks like that. And there's going to be a lot of trace minerals, a lot of nutrients that they're kind of deficient in. And they're going to have babies. So now they have the babies. The babies start off with not the best gut flora, and the babies don't have a taste for produce because mom and dad are not giving it to them. So the kids, when they start off, their first meal, how many people give their kids rice cereals, their first food, solid food?
I think it's pretty common.
And I don't agree with that at all. I think the first, I mean, you keep kids, see, if I it were up to me, I would keep kids away from grains as long as possible.
Right. I think there's like the rice thing, and then there's the applesauce thing, and there's the, the kind of saucy, everything's kind of saucy.
Yeah, but the thing is, to start a kid on grains, there's something, in my opinion, there's something wrong with that. That you want to start a child, if the way we were supposed to eat in paleo times was protein and produce, why not start your kid on protein and produce?
You
start it on real food that they can actually eat. So, you start them on mushy things. Give them a banana. Give them an avocado. Give them things that grow in these climates that are in a form that they can consume. So, you give them mushy cherries. Give them mushy blueberries.
Right.
And that would kind of be better for them even. I don't think the avocado is too bad because it's not too high in sugar. People think of bananas because they're easy to eat. But bananas, quite honestly, don't grow here.
No, they
grow
don't.
They grow in the tropics, and we eat them all the time.
Central America and South America.
Right.
Yeah.
And Florida. They grow in Florida. They grow
in the
tropical, subtropical United States.
Yeah.
If you go to Florida, you'll see banana trees.
Mm.
People will have banana trees in their yards. So bananas are kind of a funny food. It's really a good idea to eat foods that at least grow in your latitude. So berries and cherries are a great idea for us. For us to eat blackberries, perfect. Even if they're coming from somewhere else, at least blackberries are designed for this latitude. Because we know blackberries are designed for this latitude because apparently they're designed for our yard.
They grow in our yard.
Yeah,
yes.
And raspberries too, and blueberries.
Mm-hmm.
So raspberries, blueberries, they grow quite nicely in Connecticut.
And they grow wild.
And strawberries, yes. Mm-hmm. So anything that grows wild is going to be good for you to eat, and you're going to be less allergenic there. And so I think one of the things that goes on is you have children who are weaned on processed food. Once you're weaned on processed food, you're not going to set up good microbiome. Your gut flora and the flora in your entire body is not going to be as healthful as if you're eating what you're supposed to be eating, which is protein and produce. And so if you don't have a good microbiome, you're not going to have a good immune system. You're going to have more food allergies.
So peanuts
are probably not the first thing I would give a child. First thing I would give a child, I probably wouldn't give nuts to start because nuts can be more endogenic.
Mm-hmm.
Before anybody ate anything, they ate roots and leaves. They basically ate leaves and fruit and meat. And that's what people ate. And that's where I would start a kid. And if you start a kid that way, they're going to be less likely to have allergies. All right, I'm going to let you say what you wanted to say.
Okay. Well, I got a couple things here.
Okay.
First of all, according to the European Academy of Allergy and Clinical Immunology, more than 17 million Europeans have a food allergy.
Okay.
And hospital admissions for severe reactions in children have risen sevenfold over the last decade.
In Europe. Okay.
And the other thing is that researchers are trying to discover why food allergies are on the rise in developing countries worldwide.
Wow.
So there's a connection here. That is interesting. So they're researching it. They're trying to figure out why it's happening like this, but it is definitely happening. There are 8 foods that account for 90% of all reactions.
Really?
Would you like to hear them?
Nah. Go for it.
Are you ready?
Yes.
Number 1, milk. Number 2, eggs. Number 3, peanuts. Number 4, tree nuts. Number 5, soy. Number 6, wheat. Number 7, fish and shellfish. And that fish and then a burrito is shellfish.
So
all of the, even trace amounts of a food allergen can cause a reaction on those.
So these are IgE food allergies. These
okay.
are
yeah. yes, yes. That's where I'm right. I'm at right
These
now.
Are the kind that cause hives and anaphylaxis. Yeah, that's what those are. Right. So so those are the short term. If you have an IgE food allergy, so when you test for IgE food allergies, you can be tested by skin prick, as I told you, if you go to the allergist. You can also get blood tests for them, and because you can find IgE antigens in the blood, and so you can get tests there. And some people have IgE allergies and they don't necessarily get hives or anaphylaxis, but they have other allergy symptoms. They have digestive symptoms, or they have respiratory symptoms, chronic runny nose, allergic rhinitis, or they have asthma. By the way, exercise-induced asthma is often a wheat allergy.
Mm-hmm. I'm just reading down here on this whole page, a very interesting page here on food allergies,
yes.
facts and statistics.
Right.
So, they say your food allergy risks be factors and related diseases. Your risk of having a food allergy is higher if you have a parent who suffers from any type of allergic disease, asthma, eczema, thank you, food allergies, or environmental allergies such as hay fever.
Yeah.
So you have a higher risk there. Children with a food allergy are 2 to 4 times more likely to have other related conditions such as asthma and other allergies compared to children who do not have food allergies. And food allergies may be a trigger or associated with other allergic conditions such as atopic dermatitis, and oh boy, there's one I can't pronounce, gastrointestinal diseases. So
yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
So if you have GI issues, right, then you may have more of a chance to have a food allergy, obviously.
It's
the other way around, right? Yeah, which came first, exactly.
So it's interesting because you're talking about the things that cause the anaphylactic reactions.
Mm-hmm.
And in my experience, what I see, I don't see as many people with that kind of allergy, although I might, I do see some of them. What I see more of is people that have more nonspecific stuff. And don't necessarily get hives and don't necessarily get eczema, but have digestive issues, certainly digestive issues and ongoing immune issues. I see people come in because to me, mostly they will come in if they have eczema, and you'll see food allergies that are related to the eczema. But they come in with digestive more often. I see digestive upset. I see allergic rhinitis. I see some asthma. I don't see as much asthma as I see allergic rhinitis, but I see a lot of digestive upset. Because you can kind of manage allergic rhinitis. You can live with it. You could blow your nose. You could take an inhaler and sort of live with it. And people just take Claritin or other drugs like that. And with asthma, they've probably been handled by their MD and been given inhalers. But if you have a chronic digestive problem, that's miserable. It makes you miserable all the time.
I
so
would
you're going to look
no
for,
idea.
Right. So you're going to look for relief wherever you can find it. So if you figure out that the naturopath can help you, you're going to go to the naturopath to get help. Because the thing is, if you use a drug approach to just correct a food intolerance or to correct digestive upset, it's usually not going to work. It works a little bit, but it doesn't really work. You really have to change your diet.
Isn't it that like a Band-Aid?
It's kind of like a Band-Aid.
You're just kind of covering it up, and
it's
you're not
usually,
really
It's
taking
usually
care
a combination
of
diet and stress, and that's what's going on. And then the other thing they come in for is pain. People will come in because, digestive upset, because, if you're looking for the bathroom all the time and your gut feels bad all the time, that's probably way worse than having a runny nose.
I remember those days.
Yeah.
I do.
And then if you're in pain, if your joints hurt, your back hurts, you can't function.
I had all of that.
Right. Mm-hmm. So people come in for that, and food intolerances can certainly cause those things. And I've seen people get off their food intolerances and have those things go away and get back on them and have them return. So I like to talk about the big bullies of food intolerance, and a big shout out to Jillian Sarnotita, naturopathic physician, for coining that term. I think she coined that term anyway. It's in a book that she wrote. So thanks to her. I want to give credit where credit is due. So the big bullies, and I've modified what I think are the big bullies. They may not be exactly the same as hers, but they're mostly the same. And they're going to be processed food, sugar, alcohol, caffeine, especially coffee, gluten, dairy, grains, and GMOs. So those are the big bullies of digestion. And we like to call them the big bullies because, you know, people look at me and say, don't take away my coffee, don't take away my bread, as if they own the bread or the coffee and I am physically taking it away from them.
Right.
But if you refer to the foods as bullies, it gives you more control because now you're calling them out for doing something mean to you.
They're doing something bad to you.
And
yes.
You can, and if you relate to the foods as being bullies to you, then you're like, hey, who do you think you are bullying me? How dare you? Then you can, it reframes your relationship with them, which is why I love that she coined that because it just reframes how you view the foods. It's not like, oh, it's this thing I love and I have to have at all times and I can't be without it. Well, you know, it's running your life. It's not being, you may think it's being, you may think it's being good to you, but it's really not. It's like your abusive relationship.
It humanizes it.
Yes, it kind of humanizes it. And it also gives you back some power because it's saying, I'm not going to stand for being bullied. And so then you take a look at the big bullies. Like before you go getting a food allergy test, you might want to consider getting off the big bullies and see what happens. Because, you know, processed food has all kinds of chemicals in it, which our bodies don't know how to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And then sugar. Sugar has many issues. It raises your insulin too much. It increases inflammation. And it upsets your microbiome in a way, your gut flora, the probiotics that live in your digestive system and in the rest of your body. So it tends to make your digestive system run toward anaerobic bacteria and increasing yeast, all of which can cause hormonal changes, mood changes, neurological changes, all kinds of stuff in your body, and definitely immunological changes. So sugar will mess up your microflora. So, and then alcohol, if you're drinking too much alcohol, that hijacks your liver. Your liver prioritizes getting rid of alcohol, so it's not as available to do other kinds of metabolism in your body. Caffeine, especially coffee. So caffeine is a special case because if you are a fast metabolizer of caffeine, that is your CYP1A2, that's your cytochrome P450 enzyme that breaks down caffeine, is rapid. And you don't also have a GI reaction to coffee because coffee has oils in it and principles in it that are not just the caffeine that are irritating. And if you don't have those problems, coffee can be quite good for you. It has a lot of, especially if it's organic, coffee has bioflavonoids. It improves blood sugar regulation. It improves liver function. It prevents gallstones. It does a lot of good things for you. But if coffee makes you sick, if it gives you digestive upset and it gives you headaches and it makes you tired, first of all, you're probably a slow metabolizer of caffeine. And second of all, it's not good for you. So coffee is a special case where if it's good for you, it's good for you. If it's not, it's not. Same with caffeine from other sources and with things like green tea. Depending on the tea can also, if tea has a lot of tannins in it, it can be irritating to your digestive system. And if you're a slow metabolizer of caffeine like me, even drinking too much tea can be an issue. On the other hand, organic tea, you know, the plant that makes green tea, black tea, white tea, they're all the same plant, just it's the level of fermenting that's different. That plant is very good for you. It has wonderful immune properties. It's good for your liver. It's antiviral. It's antimicrobial. It's really healthy for you. But if the caffeine bothers you, it's not good for you. And there are other plants that have caffeine in them, like mate, which is a South American herb that has caffeine. There's many, many. There's thousands
cocoa.
Of plants. Cocoa, yes,
right.
Indeed. And again, some people are so sensitive to caffeine that they can't do a lot of chocolate.
Yeah.
That it's enough to upset them. Cola. And one of my favorites, guayusa, And guayusa is something, guayusa is a plant that's another rainforest plant that has caffeine in it. And it gives you a slow, even buzz. So it's, I put it in my water bottle for exercising because I find it has wonderful antioxidants in it, has a bit of caffeine in it, and it helps my workout. So I prefer to have that in my water. And it's easy on the stomach. So I will put that in my water bottle over coffee. And I find it more of a mellow stimulus than even green tea. So I don't put green tea in my water bottle. I put the guayusa in my water bottle preferentially. So caffeine, if your belly is really irritated, you might want to consider looking at how much caffeine you're consuming because it can be irritating. So then you have gluten, of course, and all the issues with gluten. And gluten can be an issue of making antibodies to gluten, and it can be an issue of eating modern wheat. And there are people, I heard recently, a young lady went over to Lithuania and spent time in Lithuania and ate wheat over there, and her digestive problems all went away. She was sick in the United States, and she was healthy in Lithuania, even though she was eating wheat in both places.
Hmm.
So clearly, there's something wrong with the wheat in this country.
Won't point at any big seed companies.
So there's modern wheat. Mm-hmm. There's issues with modern wheat in this country that has to do with the amylopectin A and the gluten. And so one of the things that can happen is when you eat food intolerances, things that irritate your digestive system, they can breach the lining of your small intestine, and you can get that thing that they like to call leaky gut. Anyway, it breaks the brushboard, it breaks the tight junctions between the villi, the places where you absorb your food, and you wind up absorbing more antigens, more proteins than you're supposed to in an under-digested form, and your body sees those and develops antibodies to them. So you're not really allergic to broccoli or strawberries. It's that strawberry and broccoli antigen got into your blood, and your body's like, what's this doing here? And makes antibodies
it's
to
fighting
it.
Yeah, sure.
Right. So it's not a true allergy. That the things that irritate you every day are really the problem, and your level of allergenicity is going to go down if you can heal the lining of your gut. And the things that tend to irritate your gut over and over, processed food, sugar, alcohol, caffeine, especially coffee, if you're sensitive to it, gluten, dairy, grains, GMOs. Those are the big things.
Wow.
Now, you talked about the IgE allergens. Mm-hmm. Quite honestly, I don't see as many people having problems with some of the ones that you said. Now, people can have problems with nuts. They certainly can. They can have a nut allergy and a seed allergy. They can also have a peanut allergy. And those are usually IgE. But you can be allergic to those things via other antibodies.
Sure.
And eggs and shellfish and fish, I don't see those as commonly as I do people having problems with eating too much of the big bullies, which is irritating their digestive system, which is making it so that they make antibodies to other things. So naturopathic physicians have allergy tests that we can do that are not just IgE. They have allergy tests where they test IgG, which is the longer, slow-reacting immune food allergy testing. And those allergy tests, again, I think to some extent are incidental because they're a result of the irritation of the lining because people are eating too much of the big bullies. But you can get those food allergy tests. Those tests are usually not covered by insurance. You can also get tested for food allergies via IgA, immune globulin A, which is the antibody that sits on the lining of your digestive system and respiratory system and is one of your first defenses against invaders. And those are available from naturopaths and from other kinds of functional medicine practitioners. I am not 100% sure how useful they are because I like to work with people on the big bullies first. But if people insist and they really want a food allergy test, I will have them do it. I also will do it when people have gone around the block and they've already done the big bullies and they still don't feel good. And then I'll do another test. All right.
So we had, speaking of IBS, we had Chuck call from Tallinn, who said hi to you, by the way, and listens to us all the time. He would like you to elaborate on, we talked about bone broth last week, and he was curious as to If you could elaborate on the bone broth and IBS.
Right. Okay. So bone broth, when you make bone broth, of course, you are taking a healthful animal, an animal that's been, you know, raised healthfully, a grass-fed beef bone, healthfully raised pork bone, or a free-range chicken that's been, you know, as organically raised as possible. And you enjoy the meat off of that bone. And then you place the bone or the carcass in a crock pot, and you cover it in water, and then you boil it. But where you put it, you heat it on high for an hour, and then you heat it on low for 24 hours, and then you consume the bone broth. And so you're going to be getting, so it's really great for healing the digestive system, because it basically provides, it has stem cells in it, it has marrow, it has everything you need to help rebuild your gut lining. It has collagen and protein and immune compounds and all kinds of stuff. It's just building blocks to rebuild the gut lining. So if you drink that regularly, then you're going to get those nutrients to help rebuild. So if there's an irritated, inflamed, or breached gut lining, it's going to have a lot more integrity. And then if at the same time you eat foods that help to promote healthy gut flora, you're going to be able to hold on to that healthy gut flora. So that's basically
So go it. For it, Chuck. Go for the bone broth.
If you would like to do that, yes.
Yeah, sounds like a good thing. All right.
Yeah.
Cool.
So those. So that's food allergies 101.
We could spend many shows on this.
This
is like a big deal. It seems like our system is not good as far as our food system goes.
Yeah, so if you have questions on this, we may elaborate on this a little bit more next week. But if you have questions about this, you could think them up and get them to me. You can write me at Radio Naturopath. You can always call at 860-486-9487 or text at that same number. So to give you something to think about, are there any foods that are bothering you? If you have food intolerances, you can go and get tested and checked and get some support from a practitioner that can help you with that. All right. So our hour is up for Radio Naturopath. It's been a pleasure being here and helping you out with some more information. And we will be back with more Radio Naturopath here on 91.7 FM WHUS Stores.